Good evening.
Good evening.
So, thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you.
especially when I come to a Zen place, you know, I feel like we're meeting in the sweetness of our hearts because we share this tradition. So it's kind of nice. It's a little different than last night. We're all together and we're sharing, but somehow I feel more a bit of a heart connection with the Zen people. I'm cultivating this new practice. It's called making eye contact. I started this sometime last year. I went to a class, not a class, but a, well, like a class, but it's called Speaking Circles. And you have like 7 or 8 people. And each person has a couple of times to get up and talk in front of the group. And before you talk, you have to make eye contact with each person you're going to be talking to. And then while you're talking, you're always making eye contact with someone. And then you can't just look at one person. You have to keep looking around. And I realized that... and then after you're finished, you know, so everybody's listening, we think. It feels like it, because you're making eye contact with somebody. You feel like people are listening. And you can say whatever you want. Or nothing. You can just stand up and make eye contact with people. And then when you're done, each person who's been in the audience gets to say 2 words about your sacred spirit. Not about the content of anything you said. But just what's this person's heart? You know, sincere, bright, holy, mountain, creek, sort of like our Buddhist names sometimes, you know, dragon, elephant, bamboo, cushion. So what do you sense from this person that's more like core or essence? And then once each person says their 2 words, you get to say, thank you. It's very sweet. So I started seeing if I could remember to do this from time to time. So it's and sometimes I go and I, you know, actually it takes a while, you know, to go around the whole room.
Yeah.
And to make eye contact with everybody. But people notice it. And last year, after I'd started doing this practice, I was in a meeting of, you know, very senior Zen people. And there was almost no eye contact ever. I'm looking around the room and people are not... or they're inward, they're looking down. So it's very interesting. And then when they were talking, they're just kind of talking... about what's going on. We were doing, you know, a so-called check-in. And people have done some amazing things, you know, but it's just kind of like talking to the floor. tell the floor about the things you've been doing. So, very interesting. So, I recommend this. And then this weekend... you know, when I'm at home, I do very few practice discussions, my practice discussions, I don't even call them Dokusan. Do you know, the formal interview with the teacher? Because Dokusan, I don't even know what makes it Dokusan. I'm that ignorant, you know. And I think for Dokusan, you have to have certain bows, and, you know, and you should bow 3 times to the altar and then once to the teacher and then this and that. And, you know, and I don't even know the whole form, so I can't call what... If people come to talk to me, it's just practice discussion. Because I don't know how to make sure that it's Doksan. It's official and it counts, you know. So we just talk. But up here I was doing practice discussion here with a few people this morning and then also yesterday morning. And I started and I noticed how much, you know, I don't you know, we're talking but I'm not looking at them. And especially when somebody asks me something and I don't know what to say, it's like and so I tried out, like, okay, I'm just going to look at you, and then some words come or they don't. Rather than I look away and wait for the words to come. And then, you know. But so it's been very interesting. I actually feel like, you know, it's called face-to-face meeting, you know, teacher-student meeting. Yeah. So I've been actually finding out that it's, you could do that. You could actually meet face-to-face. Eye to eye. Pretty amazing. Interesting. And there's you know, something about that where neither person is in charge. Something happens in face to face. There's some. And it's hard to describe, isn't it? What's happening when you actually meet face to face? Because it's not like I'm telling you what to do or what to think, and it's not like you're telling me. We know we're sharing things, but you know, there's something bigger, so to speak. So pretty interesting. So if you don't mind, I'll just keep doing this. And see if I have anything to say or not. and actually, you know, my plan for tonight, I wasn't planning to say any of this. Right, so... that's all free. That's extra. that's the bonus content here. I've been actually, you know, I gave some talks on Saturday here, and I gave a talk last night. And I thought I'd give you the same talk. Sort of. But, you know, I thought I would see if I could make it a little more Zen flavored, since this is a Zen group. So I'd like to start out with an old Zen teaching. I'm not sure who said this, but the Zen teacher said, "You are the secret." Got it? So, because this is a little at times... I told people yesterday, you know, some of you were here, and I mentioned about the morning Suzuki Roshi in meditation, but in the Sesshin, started talking, and he did this about once a year. And he said, and we're all sitting, you know, facing the wall, so we're not looking at him. He starts talking, and he says, "Some of you... you think I'm the teacher and that you're the student, and I'm going to explain to you things that you don't understand." That's wrong thinking. Some of you think that I know things that you don't know, and I'll tell you about them. That's wrong thinking. That's a mistake. And then he went on, "Sometimes the teacher is the student. Sometimes the student is the teacher. The student bows to the teacher. The teacher bows to the student." And he talked about this for a little bit. And then at some point he would jump up with his little stick. And then we were sitting facing the wall. And then he went over to the first person at the front of the row over there and put the stick on the shoulder. You can't see it, of course. but you know what's going on. And then he yelled out, "Who is the teacher?" And then he puts the stick on the shoulder. And when you feel the stick on your shoulder, you would, you know, you have to bow and then get your head out of the way. So there's a good shot at this broad muscle here. And he would hit you twice. Whack, whack. And it was so fast and so unexpected. And everything would disappear. And I mean everything. No space, no time, no thoughts, no feelings. Just like we just chanted. And then you'd wait, like, and then you might think, like, where did it all go? And after a while, oh yeah, I'm in the Zendo. I'm sitting on the cushion, and you start to figure it out again, you know. And the first person, who's the teacher? Bap, bap. Second person, who's the student? Whap, whap. Third person, who's the teacher? Whap, whap. And after about five or six people, he ran out of breath and just went around the whole room. 90 people. Whack, 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 whack. And then he got back and sat down. And when he first said, you know, this is a mistake, I thought, uh-oh, if I have to be the teacher, we're in trouble. But it turns out, you know, we're fortunate, you know, that, and this brings up this other story, you know, that, does somebody remember, was it Hyakujo who said, all of you gobblers of dregs? If you keep on like this, when will you have today? All of you gobblers of dregs, you know, you're chasing after teachings and sayings and things that you can, that, and that's other people's lives. Other people have been living their lives, and this is the dregs. There's, what they talk about is just the dregs of their experience. And then you gobble them because you think that it's going to help you. And the teacher said, if you keep on like this, when will you have today? When will you have this moment? And then, of course, and then he said, haven't you heard in all of China there are no teachers of Zen? And a monk got up or came up and said, but teacher, there's hundreds of monasteries and thousands of monks. How can you say there's no Zen? And he said, I didn't say there was no Zen. I said there were no teachers of Zen. So, in a different vein, I will give you a story about this. I tried being a Zen teacher for a while. I was the head resident. I had a position at Gringotts, head resident teacher. It was 1985. So it was after the fall of the empire, so to speak, after the Zen Center Armageddon and Bakuroshi had gone on leave. He was on leave still at that point. So there was a lot of tension and conflict in the air because there were still students who were, you know, Baker Roshi is enlightened and Suzuki Roshi has authorized him to be abbot, and how can you, you know, attack him, and what's wrong with you people, and let's get him back, and he needs to be our teacher and we want him back. And then other people are like, he's got problems, he's just a human being, you know. And if he could admit, so some people are saying, if he could admit that he was a human being, we could have him back. And other people are saying, no, we don't want him to be a human being, he's an enlightened Buddha, he's a teacher. He's it. He's the cat's meow. So it was, you know, so these two sides, we, you know, couldn't agree on who he is. Who is he? And so Katagiri Roshi came to visit. He was the interim abbot of Zen Center, including Green Gulch. And so the next morning after he had arrived, he said, "Well, I'll have tea with everybody. Let's have tea." So we all got together in what was the library in those days. It's all been remodeled now. And we're sitting and we have tea, you know, so we have our tea and take a sip of tea and we have some little cookies and something. And after we've sipped our tea and eaten a cookie or so, tiny little cookies. And then Kaliguru Rishi says, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you very much for hosting me. And it's nice to see all of you. And does anybody have any questions? So right away, gentleman had a question. It was someone that he had been Shuso, and I had been the head of the practice period. So I had congratulated him on being Shuso. And I had expressed my appreciation for his practice and various things. But he raises his hand and he says, "Kaliguru Rishi, what do we do when there's no teacher around?" Well, there are none in all of China. Why would there be any at Gringos? But he said, it was so sweet, so nice. And he said, "When there's no teacher, keep a warm spot in your heart for the teacher. Keep a warm spot in your heart for the teacher." And that's really stayed with me because that's the teacher. It's not anybody outside. It's the warm spot you have in your heart to receive teaching. So you keep that spot warm. It's up to you. You be the teacher. And you have that warm place that, whether it comes from inside or outside, small, big, magnificent, not so magnificent, something comes. What is it? So, you know, Kaliguru Rishi visited us with for 40, 45 minutes or something, and then Michael Winger and I walked back with him from the library to the guest house at Green Gulch. Beautiful buildings that Paul Disco built with his Zen Center cruise. There was a time when people could be at Zen Center and study Japanese carpentry. It was amazing. And so Michael Winger and I walked back to the guest house and we got to Kaliguru Rishi's room. Kaliguru Rishi opens the door to his room and I say, "Roshi," he turns around to say goodbye and I say, "Roshi, excuse me, but if there are no teachers at Green Gulch, what should I call myself?" And Kaliguru Rishi says, "A teacher." It's so interesting. It's also kind of ironic and funny, and you know, so we don't know though, teacher student. And for the most part, so I've been sharing a poem this weekend. I was going to say, for the most part, we're not really ready to receive teaching unless there's some problem. Something's not working. If you don't have any problems, it's hard to receive teaching. Who cares? You've got better things to do. So mostly we only look around for teaching when our usual habitual track is, you know, somehow blocked. And life circumstances, things happen. Or some of us I don't have enough problems, so I think I will practice sitting. that should give me some problems. My leg hurts. My back. My mind is all over the place. then you have to decide, of course, if this is a good place to have your problems, or you'd rather have them somewhere else. And, some of you, like, sitting in chairs aren't having enough problems. Sit on the floor. Of course, some of you have been there, done that. So, and I'm headed that direction, too, you know. I'm already not, you know, sitting cross-legged. I mean, you know, half lotus anymore, so I've got my prop here. I'll share with you, just to bring you up to date, in case you weren't Saturday or Sunday, when I shared the poem by Rainer Maria Rilke about you are the secret. He said, you see, I want a lot. I don't know, maybe that's not very Buddhist, huh? You should be content with little. But Rilke says, I want a lot. That's, you know, what Katagiri Roshi called the flower of your life force blooming. The problem is, I just came across again the quote from Zen Master Joshu. He said, passions are the Buddha. Buddha is the passions. And a monk said, how do I get rid of these annoying passions? And Buddha said, why would you do that? But mostly, of course, we have a picture of what would be the kind of mind to have. I will sculpt it, I will shape it, I will craft it to be a Buddha mind or a Zen mind. How's it going? And we keep our picture, and then we stay devoted to our picture and attaining that picture, bringing it about. And they're like, oh, I'm such a miserable student, I can't get that picture to come true. So, excuse me, a story about that. We'll get back to that other poem. We got off from our poem, excuse me. I'm rereading Time of the Spring, which is a book of translations by Tom Cleary or J.C. Cleary or both of them. Tom Cleary, I think. And it was one of their first translations in Baker Roshi. You know, Ascents, and we need to support them and pay for this book to be published. And we supported Tom Cleary for some number of months while he was working on those translations and got the book published. And Baker Roshi had the concept of the monks on the cover are walking towards you and the monks on the back cover are walking away from you. It's a cute little book. Anyway, there was a Japanese Zen teacher, and I don't remember his name, but... he'd been practicing for years and years and years. And one morning he was bowing. It was morning, not night, like we did. And he was getting up from the bowing mat and he saw the light coming in the window. And the world changed. And he realized everything is new. Everything is new. he'd never seen everything new before. And then he, all of you gobblers of dregs, when's it going to be new? Because if you keep in your mind all of those dregs, how's it going to be new? How are you going to experience anything new? So he said, everything is new. And then he wrote a poem. For 30 years, I've been trying to sweep away the dust. Now I can see that my sweeping was just more dust that kept me from seeing. Now I see everything is completely new. And that was his, poem, awakening poem. Everything is completely new. For 30 years, I tried to craft that Buddha mind, that picture, and I was getting rid of this and promoting that, and I was going to get it all just the way it, the picture that I have, the way it should be. I mean, isn't that what Zen practice is about? Or is it? This is the question, since I'm in the teacher's seat. anyway, you see, I want a lot. The darkness of each infinite fall, the shivering blaze of each step up. Isn't that good? I want a lot. I'm not just trying to get the good stuff and get rid of the bad stuff. I want it all. That's Rilke's genius, And that's Joshu. Passions are the Buddha. Buddha is passions. Why would you want to get rid of them? Because you think, Buddha, I want Buddha. I don't want the passions. Is Buddha passions? Passions Buddha? Is that true? Is that not true? Which is which? How do you know? You see, I want a lot. Perhaps I want everything. The darkness of each infinite fall, the shivering blaze of each step up. There are those who live on and want little, and they're raised to the rank of prince by the slippery ease of their light judgments. But what you love to see are those who feel thirst, are people who feel thirst. There's so many people that... Don't I look good? Oh, I don't have needs. I don't have thirst. You start seeing thirst and it's like, oh, a live one. they're not hiding at all. They're showing something here. But you love those who feel thirst. Most of all, you love those who feel thirst and do work. Do work. Most of all, you love those who need you like a crowbar or a hoe. You got a chance to do some work here. Most of all, you love those who feel thirst and do work. Most of all, you love those who need you like a crowbar or a hoe. It is not too late, and you are not too old to dive into the increasing depths of your life where it calmly gives out its secret. So that warm spot in your heart, you have to do some diving to have that start to something come through that warm spot. It's curious, obviously I've been practicing for a while. Sometimes at the end of a meditation or a talk, I say, you know, and we're going to sit for 10 minutes and that'll be the end of the day. And before you know it, you know, 50 years will have gone by. That's what happened to me. But, you know, so I sometimes, you know, like after last night, I give this talk and I talk about any number of things and listening to your heart and your felt sense, your hara, and then I get home and think, maybe I should just tell people to follow their breath. do some work. Be mindful of the breath. And it's very interesting. It is so hard. And one of the things that's hard is, you know, it's so, I mean, because it's so easy to have a picture of how the breath is about to go. And then you already want to make sure it goes that way. Or like if you start to breathe and like, oh my God, it just went some way that I, oh my, what is it doing? Everything's completely new. Uh-oh. I mean, if it's completely new, this could be scary, couldn't it? Or do we trust our breath to know what it's doing, even though we're not making sure that it's doing what it should be? This is very interesting. You know, can we trust the world to appear without our having to, like, make sure it's doing what we want it to? Like, so sometimes I would sit and like, okay, now this time I'm going to allow my breath to go however it wants, however it goes, and I'm not going to tell it to go anyway in particular. Like, well, come on. and I'm waiting and nothing's happening. This is like meeting, you know, eye to eye and face to face. You meet your breath this way. And when you meet, because your awareness has to, if you're aware of your breath, you have to participate with your breath, but you're also trying to allow your breath to be itself. And for you not to be telling your breath what to do next. Keep inhaling, or stop inhaling now, or inhale this way, or feel that way, or do that. You know, you want to be allowing it to start as it feels like starting, and go as it feels like going. And you have to participate with that, or nothing happens. And after a while, you can't hold your breath anymore waiting for it. You have to. So it's very interesting. It's very, it's a very, you know, subtle practice. To understand everything completely new, your breath. Is that okay? For it to be new? Different? Each breath different? New? Very interesting. So, for instance, one of my students, and this is a big deal sometimes. One of my students, I saw her 2 or 3 years ago, and I hadn't seen her in a while, and she looked amazing. She was beaming. She looked 15 years younger. She's a woman in her 60s, maybe in her 70s, and she was looking 50, 45. And I said, you look fabulous. What's going on? And she said, well, this is someone who did years of Zen practice. You know, San Francisco Zen Center, Tassajara, Green College. And then she moved away from Zen Center for various reasons. And she found a Vipassana teacher. And she started doing Vipassana. And One day I was talking with her and she said, Ed, this is amazing. They're actually teaching Buddhism. Because then people are, you know, giving you these stories and telling you to try harder and wake up and, you know, and especially if you, you know, listen to the Japanese teachers, it seems like there's this kind of set of slogans that you hear over and over again. Awaken Bodhi mind. And then you're like, okay. But it's not something you can actually do. You know, but that's the slogan for the day or whatever. Or Kategori Rishi for a while was saying, you know, go wash your face. And we had a whole Shosan ceremony where people were asking questions and he'd say, they'd say, why is there all this suffering? And Kategori Rishi would say, go wash your face. And then after a while, the next person, go wash your face. And then what? Wash it again. What do you mean, go wash your face? Well, wash your face and see. So he just, you know, and then it's only like months or years later you hear the story that, you know, somebody wakes up in the morning and it just like, it's just so horrible to have to get up, you know, to be woken so early in the wake-up bell. And my partner Marga was, you know, at the Zen Center, she always says, it saved my life, you know, I was so scattered and I was so out of it, you know, but I hated that wake-up bell. So you hate the wake-up bell and it just stinks, you know, and then you have to get your clothes on. It just stinks, and it's just so smelly, and it just, you're just so disgusting. And then you have to go meditate, and it's so horrible, and it's cold, and it's miserable, and everything is just so, it just stinks. It's rotten. It's terrible. And then going to work, and you have to change your clothes and get to work, and then, you know, and it's horrible. It's just miserable. And finally, sometime in the afternoon, you realize you have some shit on your nose. And you clean it off, you wash your face. And then everything is completely new. But in the meantime, like, who knew? So, but in Vipassana, there's all that, you know, you could be mindful. And then you could practice, you know, joy, ease, mental one-pointedness, application, sustained application, and then there's these hindrances, and then, you know, and there's sense desire, and there's hatred, and then there's, you know, sloth and torpor. And sloth and torpor is like when the water is, it's all like water, and the sense desire is like these bright colors swirling it, and the anger and hatred is like there, the water's all roiling, and then the sloth and torpor is like the water is all scuzzy and nothing's, and there's mosquitoes on the surface. But, you know, faith, with faith you dive into this, and faith clears the water, and, you know, and so you get all this actual, you know, Buddhism. So my student, you know, we were talking with her, and she said, Ed, they're teaching Buddhism. I said, yeah, I know. That's what I found out after I did all those years of Vipassana after Zen Center. So it turned out then, this time when I talked to her, and she had looked so different and refreshed, we're coming to the end of our time. She said she was at a Vipassana retreat, and they have group interviews. So at the group interview, she said to the teacher, you know, when I follow my breath, in order to stay with my breath, I have to make it a certain length. I have to make it in, out, in, out. And then I can stay with my breath. I can follow it. I make it a certain way, and then I can stay with making it that way. If I just allow it to go some way, I can't follow it. And then the teacher started saying, and is this happening, and is that happening? And she says, yeah. And after four or five of those questions, he says, you know, it's quite likely that you have, you know, some leftover trauma in your life, and you could use some therapy.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you let go of your breath and allow your breath and you're not just telling it what to do, then something new could come up, like all the feelings that are below the surface when you're not busy sweeping away the dust. Anyway, that was for her. We're not knowing. We don't know for you, any of you. And so then she said, "Well, what do you suggest?" And he said, "Well, you know, sensory experiencing is good. That's the based on the Peter Levine. And then Hakomi is good." And he said, "Well," she said, "Well, are there people you recommend?" And he says, "Well, my wife happens to do Hakomi. You could try her out, see what you think." So she did 1 or 2 years of Hakomi. And, you know, her face is just like presence. Alive. Animated. She's not, you know, being careful and quiet and crafting, you know, the proper image, the proper mind, the proper way to be. She's not busy doing that. It's all, her face is new. Moment after, her face. It's not everything, just everything out there is completely new. Everything here is completely new. This person is new and alive and animated and expressive. So I'm going to finish up because it's that time of the evening. So I'm thinking I will share one more non-Buddhist poem with you, but it's close, you know, it's Rumi, Sufi, Zen. This is one of my favorite Rumi poems. Did I tell you the Rumi poem last night? I don't think I did. I think I used it Saturday, but not last night. So it'll be new for some of you. And then for those it's not new, it's new. That was new. So Coleman Barks did all these translations. Robert Bly one time said to Coleman Barks, "Coleman, I think you should get these poems by Rumi out of their cages." And then Coleman spent years doing that. Astounding, you know. And if you have a chance, you know, Coleman Barks does a poem called The Tavern. It's on YouTube. I'm sorry, I was using that poem last year, so it's not quite at the... But he says, "All day I think about it, and at night I say it. Where did I come from? What am I supposed to be doing here?" And he says that tavern I came from, you know, when I get back around to that place, I'll be completely sober. Meanwhile, I'm like a bird in a strange aviary, sitting with all these other birds, waiting. But one day, I'm going to be flying off, going home. Anyway, I'm not going to tell you that poem tonight, but on YouTube, Coleman Bark is... He starts out talking about how he just got back from Afghanistan. And he said, "Can you believe it? The U.S. State Department asked me to go to Afghanistan and share poetry." And so I was at the Ministry of Culture. And he says, "Can you believe it? They have a Ministry of Culture. Do we have a Ministry of Culture? Do we have a culture?" And he says, "They have a Ministry of Culture." And I, as I was reciting the poems in English, they were all saying the poems to themselves in Farsi. They knew them all by heart. And he said this one poem that he did, I think it was the Tavern, or it was one of these poems anyway. And he said, you know, who looks out from my eyes? Who hears with my ears? This is classic Zen. Who hears with my ears? Who looks out from my eyes? Who's thinking these thoughts? And of course, if you start asking and if you start looking closely, you can't find who. Which is important, you know, kind of realization. Anyway, Coleman Barks then does this poem with a man named David Darling, who's playing jazz cello. To Coleman Barks doing the Tavern. Anyway, if you have a chance. Excuse me, I'm getting distracted again. We'll finish up here shortly. So the poem I have, the Rumi poem I have for you tonight is Story Water. I just wanted to let you know that the people who work on these things, like Coleman Barks, he's an extraordinary man. You know. And so the story water is, a story is like water that you heat for your bath. It takes messages from the fire to your skin. It lets them meet, and it cleans you. A story is like water you heat for your bath. Takes messages from the fire to your skin. It lets them meet, and it cleans you. Very few of us can sit down directly in the fire, like a salamander or Abraham. Usually we need some intermediaries. A feeling of fullness comes. Usually it takes some bread to bring it. Beauty surrounds us. Mostly we need to walk in a garden to know it. The body itself is a screen to shield and partially reveal the light that's blazing inside your presence. That's one of my favorite lines from all of poetry. The body itself is a screen to shield and partially reveal the light that's blazing inside your presence. We all have that. Light blazing inside our presence. Most of all, you love those who feel thirst and do work. You see the light. And you love it when you see it. the body itself is a screen to shield and partially reveal the light that's blazing inside your presence. Stories, water, the body, all the things we do are mediums that hide and show what's hidden. Study these and enjoy this being washed with a secret you sometimes know and then don't. That's very gracious, isn't it? It's not like you should always know the secret, but keep a warm spot in your heart. You know, and experience things and being washed by things and enjoy this being washed with the secret we sometimes know and then don't. And, you know, I'm afraid too much of the time, you know, if we're not careful, we're busy. We're not appreciating the secret here because we're looking, we have our mind set on how we think, you know, we need to make our awareness, our mind or our presence, or you know, how we're going to get rid of this and you know, pick up that and make it like this. And I call it mind management. Too much of Buddhism seems to be about mind management rather than about everything is completely new. Warm spot in your heart. Understand? All right, enough said. Thank you for your time. Blessings. Thank you. Can I just have a little postscript to this? Because we just did this wonderful chant, you know, the four vows in Toledo. I love visiting the Zen Center there, and one of the reasons I love visiting them is they have a different version for the four vows. And the kids there just love this version. And they have, on the Sunday mornings when the people get together and sit, they have a Sunday school, and then the kids come out and sing the four vows. We're gonna wake up all the beings of the world, all the beings. We're gonna put endless heartache to rest, achy breaky heart. We're gonna walk through every wisdom gate, walking on through. We're gonna become, you know, I don't know, we're gonna attain the Buddha's way. Yes, we will. You know, I'm not much of a singer, so I can't keep a tune, and it changes in the middle, so I'm so sorry. But the teacher there actually teaches jazz guitar at the University of Toledo, and so so it's all to a kind of country western or hillbilly kind of, you know, we're going to wake up all the beans of the world, all the beans. So it's quite a lot of fun. And the thing about it, and he said, I said, I love this. And he said, it's not exactly traditional, is it? And he said, no, it's not. And, you know, when I first, he said, when I first heard it, my cheeks tightened. But I got used to it. and the kids love it. So, anyway.
It's new.
And it's new, yeah. All right. All right, so onwards with the evening.